Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem with Unit 14 of 20, in which we're learning all of the Mishnayot in Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Right now, we're coming towards the end of the third chapter of the tractate. Last time, we looked at a series of Mishnayot that discussed the blowing of the shofar, and we saw that the text moved from a desire that we have a complete and whole entity called the shofar, that there needs to be integrity and wholeness to the physical structure of the shofar. It couldn't be incomplete in any way. It couldn't have been broken or been in parts. And then it moved on to the completeness of the sound itself. It couldn't be blocked. It couldn't be an echo. And then it moved on to the completeness of sort of one's hearing and intention in hearing. And we left off talking about the kavanat halev, the intention of the heart or the mind of the person. And we saw that the text compared, it said, like, having no kavana was like hearing an echo, right? That's what it said, because if you hear the echo, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Only if you hear the real sound, you've fulfilled your obligation. And if you don't have kavanah to live, you don't fulfill your obligation. And it used this connective word, v'chein, and so too, right? The person that walked behind the synagogue or his next house was next to it, even though he heard it, if he didn't have intention, it was as if he had only heard the echo. And I take from that that, you know, we hear a lot of background noise. You hear lots and lots of things, right? The mitzvah of shofar is predicated on hearing. But we hear lots of things. And I guess maybe to me, when the Mishnah said, you know, afal pi shezeh shema vezeh shema, even though this guy heard and this guy heard, to me the difference is, I maybe what we would say in modern times, the difference between hearing and listening. Right, I hear lots and lots of things that sort of like are background noise and an echo in the past. But when I concentrate and focus on listening to the shofar, that is when I have fulfilled my obligation. When I say this sound is a sound that I'm required to hear, and I am hearing it as that sound, that is how I have legally sort of fulfilled the obligation that the rabbis perceive that an individual has. And so up until now, we've talked about my legal intention, and now the text is going to sort of segue into maybe more of a spiritual intention, or the word kavanah maybe in the way you might be more comfortable or more natural to hear. So let's look at this text. This text is a totally different type of text. It is going to quote two cases from the Torah, and it's going to open by quoting us a verse, and then it's going to tell us something about the verse, and neither of the cases directly link to shofar. Neither of them talk about shofar. And we have to unpack the text and figure out what is this saying about shofar? What's it doing here? And this text appears here in this place. It also appears in the Mechilta. It appears in the Midrash Halacha on Sefer Shemot, right? It's from the same time period as the Mishnah. And we won't have time to really analyze the differences. I suggest you do so, because the differences really hammer home what the Mishnah's intent is, but we'll make reference to it. Okay, here's the first case. It's quoting from Shemot Yudzayin, Exodus 17. It says, V'haya kasher yarim Moshe yado v'gavar Yisrael. And it was when Moshe raised his hands that Israel overcame or succeeded. Okay, so what is this talking about? This is talking about the battle with Amalek, right? Remember earlier when we first were introduced with shofar, it was introduced to us with a verse about the battle in Jericho, when we conquered the city in seven times. And now we're getting another story of a battle. And the text, it's worth looking. You should always look up texts when you are studying rabbinic literature. But here, it really is important to look at the text and see what's going on. And so it says, I'll start with this verse. Vayevo Amalek, right. Amalek comes and begins fighting with Israel in Rephidim. This is verse 8 of Exodus 17:8. And Moshe says to Yehoshua, pick men and go out and do battle with Amalek. Okay, that sounds reasonable. Like, they're attacking. We should attack back. And it says, in Machar, Anochi nitzav al rosh hagiva v'mateh Elohim biyadai. And tomorrow I'm going to station myself on the top of the hill, right? So we had Moshe going up on the mountain at the end of chapter 2, and now we have Moshe going up again on a mountain, and he has the mateh, he has a stick of Hashem in his hands in this story, right? And we had sticks in our first chapter used to defend people, and we have sticks where Rabbi Yeshua had to come with his walking stick to show his authority to show his subserviency to the authority of Rabbi Gamliel. And now we're going to have a different stick that's going to wage battle in a different way. The Hashem stick is going to do something sort of spiritual or powerful, or I don't want to say the word magical. So what's going to happen? Why is Moshe going to go up on this hill with the stick? And it says, Yehoshua does what Moshe told him, and he fights with Amalek. And while he's fighting, Moshe, Aaron, and Hur are up on the top of this hill. And then it says, and then has our pasuk, Vayek Hasher Arim Moshe Yado Gavar Yisrael, Kasher Yanach Yado Gavar Amalek. Right? When Moshe raises up his hands, Israel starts winning. And when Moshe lowers his hands, Amalek starts winning. Amalek starts prevailing and overcoming. And so this isn't good, because we want Moshe's hands to be up. And then in Pasuk 12, Moshe's hands start to get really, really heavy. You can imagine it's hard to hold them up. So they sit him down on a stone, and each one, Aaron and Hur, on each side, like, act as support, and they hold up his hands until the sun sets. And in the end, Yehoshua is able to overcome Amalek and win the battle. And that's the end of the story. That's how it appears in the Torah. So that's how it appears in the Torah, which is interesting. It seems to imply that there's something sort of magical or superpower, right? It's interesting. They mention this staff of Hashem, but later on they just mention the arms. And so presumably in his arms he's holding up the staff. And something about this upward motion of his hands to the sky creates the magic or the power or the... maybe he's channeling the divine in some way and he's connected to the divine in some way to make Israel win. So then the Mishnah opens quoting this verse, that Moshe raises up his hands and Israel wins. And then the Mishnah asks a question, V'chi adav sh'moshe osot milchama o shavrot milchama? And the hands of Moshe, do they sort of enable the Jewish people to make war or to break war? I think the break would imply that they are like losing and therefore Amalek is winning, and the making means that they're being successful. And this is a really interesting sentence, because this sentence, if you compare it to the way it appears, as I said, in the Mechilta, is very, very different. In the Mechilta, the focus is on, it says, like, do Moshe's hands make Israel win or Israel lose, or Israel win and Amalek lose, which, by the way, is the same thing, Israel winning and Amalek losing. But and the focus is on the fact that there's like this direct spiritual, magical, prophetic, godly connection between arms up and then the victory or defeat happens. Where in our Mishnah, there's a link between arms being up and the capability of the Jewish people to do battle. The capability of them to take action and to be active participants in whatever this sort of magical thing that is happening. It's also interesting the word shovrot here, to break war, which is kind of an awkward phrase. I want to remind you, we've already had the word breakage when we were talking about the shofar, right? It said in Mishnah Vav, in 6, it talks about if you stuck together shivrei shofarot, like the broken pieces of a shofar, just to show links that this text, although not talking about the shofar, has links to the text come before it. And the next link to the text that come before it, so it sort of asks, like, what are Moshe's hands doing? What are you supposed to imagine about Moshe's hands? And then the text says, Ella. And in our printed versions, it says, Lomar Lecha, to say to you. In the manuscripts, it doesn't have that. Kol Zman, Shayu Yisrael, Mistaklim, Klape, Mala, and in the manuscript it says Plaple Lamalan, right? All the time that Israel is looking towards the upward or towards what is above them, right? Looking towards the sky, right? And this immediately makes us think of Mishnah number one in the chapter, right? What happened? What was Mishnah number one in the chapter about? It was about Kiddush HaKodesh. What happens in Kiddush HaKodesh, right? The first Mishnah said, Rehu Beit Din v'kol Yisrael. The Beit Din and all of Israel sees the moon. Well, if they're seeing the moon, where the heck are they looking? They're looking towards the sky. They're looking above them. So we have the chapter opening reminding us about Kiddush HaKodesh and the entire nation looking towards the heavens. And now we have the story where it says that Moshe's hands direct them. Right? What does it mean that they looked at Moshe's hands? That caused them to look towards the heavens. And when they looked towards the heavens, what happened? And our printed text says, "Umshabadim et libam lavim shabashamayim." And when they would enslave their hearts to their father in heaven. But if you look actually in the manuscripts of all the good versions of the Mishnah, instead of saying enslave, it says "umitkavnim," and they direct their hearts to their father in the sky in heaven, right? And that difference is essential to us, because if we have direct your hearts, then we've directly linked to the Mishnah above, and it's clear that seems to be the correct version of the text. So what happens if they direct their hearts to their father in the Shemayim, right? And we had in chapter 2 the image that of Shemayim representing the divine, right? Hayu mitgabrim ve'im lav hayu noflim. If they look towards heaven, if they direct their hearts, if they have some spiritual intention towards the divine, then they will overcome Amalek. And if not, then they fall, then they're defeated, right? And here too, this, if they do this, and if not this, is similar to the language that we had in the halachic piece, right? In Mishnah 7, right? If they heard the sound of the shofar, or if they only heard the sound of the echo. If they directed their heart, or if they didn't, right? So here too, the language mirrors the language that we had before. And so it's not Moshe's hands, the text tells us, but the hands direct the hearts and the eyes, or maybe I should say that. The hands direct the eyes towards the Shemayim, and the eyes somehow direct the hearts. And that is, and how one connects to the divine is going to affect the nation's success or their loss, right? And here the case is, and I say this compared to what we're about to see in a second, is about the whole nation working together and doing an active action that leads to their salvation. Okay, that's case number one in the Mishnah. Case number two in this story of Agadah, it says, Kayetze Badavar, Ata Omer. So similar to this, you say, the manuscript doesn't have you say. The manuscript actually brings us the beginning of the Pasuk. It says, Vayomar Hashem El Moshe, Ose Lecha Saraf, Vasim. So now we're getting a story in Sefer Bamidbar that it's important for me to tell you the background of. So let's look in Bamidbar. This is Bamidbar Numbers 21. And this is an interesting story. They're traveling in the desert. They're schlepping around, right? They've gone on a pretty serious journey. And then the people speak against Hashem. This is verse 5. And against Moshe. And they complain. Their typical complaint. Why did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread. There is no water. We've come to loathe this terrible, messed up food that you're giving us here, right? Why aren't you providing for us? And then, because they're complaining like this after all that God's done for them, in verse number 6, Vayishlach Hashem ba'am et hanechashim hasrafim. So God sends these sort of like seraph serpents, burning serpents against the people, and they bite the people, and Vayamet Am Rav Misrael, and many of the nation of Israel die because they're getting bitten by this plague that Hashem has sent them, that God has sent them. And then the nation comes to Moshe and they say, Vamru Chatanu, we've sinned, we've transgressed, Ki Dibarnu B'Hashem, because we spoke against Hashem. And they ask Moshe, will you intercede? Will you Hitpalel El Hashem? Will you intercede on our behalf? and make these terrible nachashim, these serpents, go away. And Moshe davens on behalf of the nation. And that sounds like a beautiful story. That should kind of be the end. But what's interesting is, right, and you have Moshe working as the intermediary. It's interesting in both of these stories, like what Moshe's role is. We saw Moshe as sort of the intermediary of bringing the Torah down. And like he has other types of leadership. He seems to be sometimes a vessel that the divine works through, or an someone that intercedes. Right here, he's sort of acting like a shlich tzibur. We're going to, in the fourth chapter, we're going to talk about the prayer leader and the sort of leader of the congregation and what his role is. But the story doesn't end there. It's not that Moshe prays in the end. Then Hashem says to Moshe, you have to do this kind of crazy thing. You need to make a seraph, a sim al oto al nis, right? Make this sort of fake snake figure and put it like on a flagpole. And if anyone who gets bitten, they should look at this nachash, this fake one, and they'll recover. And so Moshe makes a nachash nechoshet. There's a play on the word there, a snake out of copper. And he puts it on this sort of like flagpole, right? And anyone who's bitten looks at it at v'chai and lives. And then that's the end of the story, right? So it seems to be this crazy thing that there seems to be some type of go-between, but that Hashem requires, it's not enough to just for them to feel bad and want Moshe to intercede on their behalf. They also have to do some type of action of looking upwards, right? They're looking at this copper snake, but they are looking upwards. And then they are healed. They live. So the same thing, the Mishnah quotes those verses and then says, V'chi nachash memit o nachash mechayeh? And is it this copper nachash, right, that that causes death or that causes life, that brings someone to life, back to life? Rather, Ella, in the manuscript says, Kol zman shayu Yisrael mistaklim klapi malmalan. Rather, all the time that Israel would look to what's above them, and here it seems to have umshabadim et libam lavihem shabashamayim, and enslaves their heart to the Father who's up in the shamayim, hayu mitrapim, they become healed. V'im lav hayu nimokim, they start to, and if they don't look up, they start to rot or to decay or become putrefied. It doesn't seem very pleasant at all. And so here we have a text that is not talking about life. It's not talking about winning or losing a war. It's talking about life and death itself, about healing. And that obviously it is the divine who heals and brings life and death. But to have the divine do that action, human beings have to be active participants in some way and direct their head, their sight upwards, not just physically by looking, but that looking upwards causes some feeling inside in which they understand their dependence on the divine. And here, the case of the nachash, the case of the snake, is a little different than the case of Amalek. Because in the case of Amalek, right, we said it was, there it was the whole nation needs saving and the whole nation works together and then it is saved as a nation. Here in the case of the Nachash, it's interesting because the plague is being sent to the whole nation. They collectively acted bad, but, and then there's sort of a collective focal point that they look at, this one copper snake, but then it's based on an individual basis. Does person X look up? Yes, he'll be saved. Does person Y do it? No, he won't be saved. And it goes by an individual person's experience. And that is the end of these two sort of agadic stories that are clearly about some understanding of spiritual intent. They're here in our chapter, so they must have something to do with shofar blowing, Rosh Hashanah, Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the new moon, but the text doesn't tell us outright. It's very subtle. And we need to think about, like, what is going on here? That's what we need to unpack. And we're going to probably need to do that next time. So I'll give you have 24 hours for you to think about what the text is saying. And at the beginning of the class next time, which will be our last session on this unit, we will have to, like, link this to the rest of the chapter, which will also be part of our review of the whole theme of the chapter, and we have to read the last little bit of this Mishnah. We didn't read the last end part of Mishnah 8. which in the manuscripts actually stands on its own. And that, I told you, if you remember, is an awkward ending to the whole chapter. Like, it's one thing if we sort of end on this powerful spiritual picture that's being presented to us in this Agadic statement, but then the text comes back to the halakha and has a section about who is obligated in shofar and who can be the one to blow. And this very fact that this is sort of out of order, this is, should have been earlier, right? Back when we said someone is, we talked about the shape of the shofar, what kind of animal it was in. And then before we got to the blowing, the one who blew into the cistern, we maybe said, who's the person who blows, right? And in the Tosefta, the additional Tanaitic material, this piece of who the person is fits right in there. But in our case, it was taken out and moved to the end. And sort of it creates an awkward ending. So the ending, we'll see, will parallel the ending of chapter 4. But I think by taking it out, we'll have to talk about this next time, it leaves the blower is anonymous, because really the blower isn't who's important. I mean, obviously you need someone to blow so you can hear the sound, but it's the hearer and what the hearer does with the sound that our chapter has been focusing on this whole time, right? Moshe here is just this vessel with his arms up, but it's what Bnei Israel do that it's important. The action that the people take using the vessel is what's important. And by skipping over the blower, when we heard the story, I think it emphasizes the importance of human action and the human listener and what you do when you hear the sound as opposed to who makes the sound. But we will continue by finishing this chapter tomorrow.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.